Hello, and welcome to the Social Care Cambridgeshire podcast series by Cambridgeshire County Council.
Hi, welcome, and thanks for joining us. Today, as part of our Social Care Cambridgeshire series, we're going to be talking about managing difficult conversations. As social workers, we know that's something we face every day, but it's still a really tough thing to handle and something we wanted to talk about a bit more today. The goal of this series is to give you an insight, an introduction into our thinking, to our teams, and to provide you with some practical tips and support along the way. I'm Anna Cullen, I'm the Principal Child and Family Social Worker for Cambridgeshire County Council, and I'm joined by Lynn Milton. And introduce yourself, Lynn.
I'm Lynn Milton, I'm the Lead for Systemic Training here in Cambridgeshire County Council.
So, the first thing actually that we need to establish is, what's a difficult conversation? I mean, this is a difficult conversation right now, but what kind of things are we actually talking about?
So I guess from a systemic point of view, we'd be asking people, what counts for you as a difficult conversation?
Yeah.
And I guess the recognition there is, what is a difficult conversation for you might be very different for a different colleague that you had. So what ideas come to mind when you think about having difficult conversations?
So for me, and so this is, you know, it's personal and it's my own experience. I used to dread knocking on people's doors when I was doing a child protection investigation and saying that's what I was there to do, expecting an aggressive response, because that would be scary. But I know for other people, it can be having to deliver some difficult news to a family they already know. So that might be having to say to a family that you've been working with that actually we're so concerned now we need to go to conference or we need to go to court. But we were saying earlier on that for some people it might be facing different sorts of aggression, or it might be about having to challenge something that happens there and then, and whether people feel resourceful about that. Because one of the things we were thinking about is sometimes you can expect a reaction and sometimes something can happen and you're thinking, oh my goodness, what happened? Where did that come from? What am I going to do to deal with this?
Yeah, so sometimes you can anticipate it's going to be difficult and other times you walk in and it becomes difficult.
Yeah.
And so you're not prepared for it.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah. And other times you've had a chance in the car to kind of get your head around a little bit. And I was also thinking about sometimes it's to do with the subject matter. So for some people, subjects around sexual abuse are harder than perhaps for some people it's working with domestic violence or a domestically abusive relationships are harder. For some families, small babies are a trigger point and things that they find more difficult. Are there other ones that come to mind?
I think we were thinking as well, and sometimes that's about the initial engagement with the family. Sometimes it can be about preconceptions. So sometimes that's about people making assumptions about you and what you stand for.
So I guess we think about context of social difference there. So the things that we bring, so that's your age, your appearance, your race, your class.
With
your
me,
culture,
it's my height.
Your height. And sometimes our accent does that. So the minute we arrive at the door, the family are already on edge and a bit annoyed because you're too young to be telling me what I need to do with my children. Or you're too old to be telling me what to do with my kids. Or you look very different from I am and I don't really want to have you tell me how it is. So sometimes what we look like when we arrive is the thing that makes it a difficult conversation. Are there other contexts of social difference that you've noticed play a part?
The obvious one is a gender difference. So I mean, particularly if we're talking about really difficult subjects, domestic abuse, sexual abuse, if you're a male worker going into to speak to a mother or female children about those kind of topics, that's you've got to really think carefully about how you're going to manage that, because I suppose it's all about, we're going into people's homes, we're going into their private lives, and sometimes we're sort of, we're coming up with some contentious and mind-blowing things for them to have to get their heads around, and we've got to think about how we present ourselves as the messenger in that situation.
So do we feel ready to move on to thinking about what your options are in those moments?
Well,
what options yes. have you? What have you done in some of those difficult times, Anna?
Well, all of them, I would think.
Run, cried.
Yes, I've managed not to cry yeah. at that point, but I've got close to it. I think what happens, and this is one of the things we were thinking about and talking about when we were planning this session, is knowing what your own reactions are to situations. Mm. So for me, the situations where something blows up and I haven't got any pre-warning of it, they can stop you in your tracks because one of the things that kicks in is your adrenaline response, you know, and because you're often dealing with crisis or very powerful, powerful negative emotions, it always spurs something in you. So I realised over the years, after trying to work out what was going on and why I was either was coming out of situations feeling very angry, I realised after a while that my fight or flight adrenaline response is anger, because that makes me active. It makes me want to do something about the situation and manage it and try and get everybody to calm down. I don't necessarily become angry on the surface, but I know that's what spurs me. I'm not someone who gets in a crisis situation. I don't necessarily get so scared I can't do anything.
Become immobilised, although I guess some workers do that.
Absolutely.
Just feel they go blank. Their mind goes, they can't think what it is they're there for.
Yeah.
They can't remember what their processes are. They become quite blank or a bit frozen in the moment as well.
Absolutely. And I think that, so that has happened to me, but when I've been going along expecting there to be a reaction to the things I've got to say. So unprompted stuff I can manage, crisis management, things where I'm anticipating something challenging, and that's actually something that we'll talk about a bit when we think about what you can actually do. But yeah, that's more likely to get me to sort of freeze a bit.
While you were talking, the other word that came to mind was about defensiveness, that sometimes knowing that one of our default reactions, which mine would be, is to be defensive, and to have my back up and be on my guard, and just noticing what that brings out in the families you're trying to talk with.
So every now and again you have to take a breath. Even I remember once having to say, can everybody just stop shouting just for a moment, just so I can think? And it just made everything stop just for a little while. I mean, that's not going to work everywhere, and I got away with it that time. But it was that breather and that moment of, actually, what's going on? Let's try and bring this down a bit. So, yeah, you can try and de-escalate, however, and you can do that by matching and pacing or trying to, you know, becoming calmer as someone becomes more, their affect goes up. Occasionally you have to think about what's really going on and whether you need to call the police, and no one ever wants to be in that situation, but sometimes you do. I think the thing is, though, if you're in that situation and you're thinking, and I don't think this is just me, but sometimes you're thinking, I just want to get out of there. You do have to balance that up with, so what's this like for this family and this child every day? How often does this happen? And you, I know you're then going into assessment mode, but you have to think, is this a one-off? And I suppose that sort of gives you questions to think about for later in the piece of work. Does this happen regularly? Is this once in a blue moon? What's it like for that child or young person in this situation?
I was just thinking also, as you were talking, that we're assuming a difficult conversation is when there's conflict. Sometimes families are very nice to us very accepting and very warm and very engaging. And yet we still have to have difficult conversations because someone's presented with an injury, or there's been a bruise and it's one of five in the last few weeks. And when we look, put that information alongside other information, we have to kind of try and pull that together and have a meaningful conversation about it, despite the fact that family might be very nice. And I was thinking, how are those conversations difficult? They're not angry, they're very smiley and nice, but you have to talk about bruises and injuries with a family that perhaps might be trying to disguise their compliance with you, or pull the wool over your eyes, or try and deflect your attention elsewhere, but doing it very nicely.
And I think you've just hit the nail on the head for the most difficult conversation of all, haven't you? Because it very much depends on the family, but you kind of need to be well prepared before that conversation. You need to get as many as your facts right as possible. You need to have the whole picture of something that may have happened, so you can go along and sort of gently challenge that.
So would a chronology be a good part for that sort of conversation?
Oh, absolutely. And speaking to people who are involved, people who know the family. Mm. Again, but that's where you start to bring in, it's where you start to look at your family situation and supportive members of the family. Mm. It might be that you need to bring an aunt or an uncle or a grandma along, or a friend, someone who knows the family and knows that something's not quite right. Mm. To challenge. Sometimes you might need to work with the child and get their point of view, and then think about how you can represent that to parents and say, but your child says this is what it feels like for them when this happens, because you're then looking for a way of making something real to them rather than just going, I know that's not true, because that's not going to help. But yes, they're the really tricky ones.
So there's something about not accepting at face value what you're being told from one person, but using the genogram, using chronology as a way of kind of getting multiple points of view as to what the lived experience of a child's life is like. And those conversations are difficult as well. Yeah.
And that sort of brings us nicely into thinking about how you can prepare. You can't prepare for every eventuality. You really can't. But you know that if you're doing, for example, a Section 47, a lot of families won't be expecting you. Mm. So there's shock there.
So I think you have assessment teams.
Often absolutely.
You have to go out quite cold.
Knock on the door.
Sometimes with the police.
Yeah. And so then you have to very quickly establish a situation and explain what's going on. Mm. And I think when you get a reaction from people at that point, what you as the worker have to remember, you have to remember a bunch of things, but one of them is you have to remember this family is worried that I'm going to remove their children right now. And so I think often, and it's something I have to consciously remind myself, when people are angry or you know, verging on hysterical or very, very up, they're worried about what's going to happen next. They're terrified. And sometimes you have to say, I can see you're very angry. Do you want to tell me why that is? Mm. And sometimes, you know, you'll get an answer. And sometimes people will be able to tell you, I'm terrified about what's going, you know, or this is a real shock. Mm. Or actually underneath, no, actually you've got me. And I know I'm now in a bunch of trouble about this, because this isn't right.
Mm. It makes me connect to the kind of systemic ideas of using mentalization techniques as a way of managing those situations, which I know a lot of the social workers who will be listening to this will be familiar with. But this idea that when someone's in that heightened state of emotional response, that there's no point trying to give them information at that point or get anything very useful at that point. You need to bring them down to where they're more level and more calm, and use yourself as a worker to get them into that place, and then you can start doing the work. But trying to assess someone when they're in a heightened state isn't useful. No. I'm trying to not use the word arousal there, and I don't know which other one there is.
No, I know what you mean. Can't use the A word. But also as well, when we were talking about this the other day, it's part of the fact that sometimes you're going to have to go back and revisit that conversation because someone might not have taken it in for one reason or another. And also they might be hitting the roof because they've just had divorce papers or something. It might not actually be about you at all.
That's true. It might be something else that's happened to them.
That's happened. And sometimes you need to establish that. I think it also helps to think of yourself as the job and not the person. So for the parent or the family, it is personal. You've walked into their home, you've made it personal to them. It's about their children, who they love. And you have to remember, actually, you're a social worker in that situation. And whilst you might get stuff come back to you that is that person making personal remarks about you, and sometimes that's hard to... it's hard to deal with, but actually it's not about you. It is the job that you represent. That can make it easier, because you're then playing a role, and you can think about things a bit more dispassionately. I think
you're connecting to another systemic idea, which is around positioning, how you reposition yourself. So perhaps families can position you as the baddie, the one that's going to take me away, to take my children away, the one that are there to criticize, tell me what to do, judge me perhaps. And sometimes that's based on their previous experience of social workers or the care system. They've come with kind of preconceived ideas as to how this conversation's going to go. And what you're talking about there, which is social workers being able to reposition themselves. So they might be positioned as the baddie, they almost sidestep that. and decide to have a different conversation. We call that having a one down, take a one down position, become more curious as to where they're coming from and what are they worried about, and address that before you get on with doing the job that you need to do. And we notice that goes a long way to helping families manage these difficult conversations.
But that also nicely leads into thinking about preparation. So it might be that you know a family have a reputation for being difficult. So you might need to think about how you handle that situation in advance. You might need to think, do I need to take a colleague along and introduce the colleague as doing some of the work? Because we know a social worker is the person who does the assessment and then delivers the sort of the outcome of the assessment. And if there's a barrier there, then you might need to think about who can actually go and do some of the work, who can just sort of just work more alongside the family. So that's something to think about. You might have to think about practical candidates like a risk assessment, or, you know, having something where you can ring the office and just say, actually, can someone be around or can someone call me? Because I think I need a way to interrupt this conversation, or I don't feel safe. Unfortunately, it does happen from time to time. You need to think about getting support when you get back.
So sort of a debriefing session or some supervision.
And you know, actually, one of the things I know about Cambridgeshire and my colleagues is they really look out for each other. You know, they all have ways of staying in touch, and they know if someone's got a difficult visit, and they'll text or they'll ring and they'll keep tabs on each other. And being able to go into the office the next day and actually just say, oh my goodness me, that was a doozy, and being able to talk it through, it helps support you, but it also helps you think about what's going on. Because the sooner you can get out of the, that was pretty horrible, to, okay, so what was really going on? Then the quicker you get through your, you know, to your assessment and planning.
And what about the families where it's difficult because they're nice? So how do you get support from your colleagues when it's a drip effect of a nice parent, but there's lots of injuries, bruises, or disclosures from children that I'm going to need to collate and take to a mother who isn't, or a parent who isn't being aggressive. How do you use your colleagues or supervision as a way to prepare or notice that this is something I need to have a difficult conversation about? Because I guess in those situations, social workers might not know immediately that that is a difficult conversation I need to have. I suppose I was thinking about supervision being taking a meta position to your work, sitting back and looking at chronologies, looking at patterns over time with families, and just noticing if the reoccurring patterns are happening.
Sure, yes, because if someone's sort of reacted the same way, it will show up. Yeah, you're right, it's about the patterns of behaviour, and it's like, so yes, someone who all of a sudden is becoming nice when they've had a reputation for being more challenging to work with, all the other way around, then your chronology will tell you a bit more about that. And yes, sometimes it is about just almost physically standing back and looking and go in a different way and thinking, so what's really going on here?
Yeah.
Because that's the question.
Yeah. And families perhaps where there's been a lot of open to social care, light touch, close. Open again 3 months later, light touch, close. Open again 2 months later, light touch, close.
So what's been going on?
Times? Yeah, that each time, are we missing something here that needs to have a difficult conversation?
And also thinking about when you're thinking about doing that visit and doing that piece of work and having the conversation, you've got to think, I'm coming through the door again and again, and this family are either now really wary about this, or they think they've worked out a way to manage us, or I think you have to think as well about the disruption for that family. And that is really difficult if you've got a situation where there's sort of conflict between parents, and there's trouble being stirred up from one person to another, because that's just wearing for everybody. So you've got to be careful you're not being pulled into the dynamic of being part of, it's oppressive, isn't it, after a while, thinking about that. So I know something our colleagues in adults talk about is respecting the home, because that's very much one of their sort of foremost concepts. We don't tend to think about it like that. We tend to think about lived experience of the child, but it's the same. It's different ends of the same idea of you're going in there and it's another disruption. So people might be being nice because they're kind of hoping that you might just go away, or there might not be anything going on, or they're trying to hide something, and it's just about having that time and space to stand back and think about what's going on here.
I'm thinking about some of the toughest conversations as well. I'm thinking about sexualized behavior in small children. So, you know, one referral at the beginning, 3 months later, another mention from school, you know, 3 months later, another mention from school. Each time, perhaps the parent says that they've addressed it. 2 months later, another mention from school, and you've got a young child. When you look back at the chronology, there's perhaps three or four times where low-level, perhaps, sexualized behavior has been mentioned, and each time our fears have been allayed. At which point do you have that difficult conversation and go to a parent and say, the fifth time's just happened, we need to now look at this a little differently, especially if that's a family that's otherwise be engaging well with us, and we don't want to spoil that relationship.
No, because we're ultimately there to help
people. We're there to help, and we don't want to be the one that tries to say that, and yet how do we get support to have those conversations as well?
Yeah, well, I suppose that's about speaking to people who are finding your colleagues who are experts for things like that, but also being really clear. It's about being really clear about what the referrals have actually been about, and about precision of language. So everything we write, everything we say, we've got to really think about what the impact is, because it can, if it's not expressed correctly, you can end up making the wrong assumption about people, and that's not going to that's not going to help anybody.
And yet similarly, if just because you don't get a disclosure from a child to a social worker, it often gets NFA'd, no further action. So because the child didn't tell us something directly, then we don't do any more about it. And yet if you have three or four of those, how do we find other ways to have those difficult conversations, be more curious around the wider network of these children, around other people who care for these kids? What ideas do they have about what might be happening to these children?
So it's the preparation and thinking about when you're laying the groundwork with families, and you find out who the go-to person is, or you know, if there's crisis, who do you ring? Who's, you know,
but your good genogram will have that on.
It will. But also working with children and saying, okay, so, you know, do you have a best friend? Who do you talk to? Do you speak to your teacher? Being clear about who those people are, so that you can call on them if you need to.
Really good. Another good groundwork, though, is when you first engage or first build a relationship with a family, is start talking then about the difficult conversations that are going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
And getting some agreement from them as to how you work, but how also do they want to receive bad information?
Yeah.
So would you like it to, if I have to have a difficult conversation with you in the future, would you like it in the office?
How are we going to do
it? At home? Yeah. How are we going to go about doing that?
Yeah.
So that you can then draw on that information a little bit down the line when you have to do it.
Absolutely, and it's about that. It's about honesty and transparency from the start. I think that's absolutely crucial, because, you know, I think as a social worker, what you're doing is your level best to get out of that person's life as fast as you humanly can. But
which is what they want as well.
It's what they want as well. Oh, yeah, agreed aims. But at some point, it might be a bit bumpy, and if you're really clear that that might happen and how that is handled, you're giving them a measure of control, which stops people, you know, getting feeling out of control. They know that there is an agreed pattern for that. So
And so once you've had a difficult conversation, you might think you know what we agreed in that. How do you go back and say and revisit it with a family to say, what do you think we agreed? What did you come away from in that conversation? And is it the same thing you think I came away from? Do we know what the next steps are? So because when you are upset and things are difficult, you might not be on the same page with regards to what happens next, and then that's a surprise, which leads to another difficult conversation.
But you're right, absolutely. If you've gone along and you've said something, and the parent is thinking, oh my goodness, that means, whether it's right or not, that means they're going to take my children away, they're not going to hear anything might be saying, I think we need to go to a child protection conference, or we might need to think about what's happening in court, or, you know, we might need to deal with, you know, the state of your house, because it's actually unhealthy for the children. They might have heard that, they would have heard something else, and you're right, you will have to go back and just say, okay, when I came around the other day, we talked about this, and I think you were upset, and I think you weren't hearing me, and And that's because, you know, I think you were scared or angry. So let's talk about what was going on and what I was trying to say there.
A nice question to ask them is to tell them, what do you think you heard? What do you think I said? Sorry, that's the question. Yeah. What do you think I said when I came to see you last week? So if they have to put it in their own words, does it give you a better idea? I knew a family who thought going to a CP conference was court.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, I think it's a common misunderstanding. Mm. But I mean, think some people. I think a lot of people think that any call to social services means that someone's going to be around, and it's round for the kids, and it happens so rarely, so rarely.
I think we should say something about the in different language the very posh families we have, because I've coached some quite ASYE social workers who are trying to find ways to escalate with a family who are very articulate, and they might get the MP involved. And
well, I suppose yes, that's about. But that could be any family, couldn't it? It could be any family that threatens to make a complaint about you or go to the HCPC about you as leverage. Mm. People who read stuff on the internet. Mm. So there is a myth going around that social workers do adoptions for bonuses, which is.
Yeah,
it's absolutely insane. We absolutely just no way. Mm. But that's kind of creeping out there.
It's grown some legs,
and you know, people, and they should. They know their rights and they know the law. Mm. And sometimes it's very easy to be deflected. And I think that's it. It's about realizing that you're being deflected from what you're there to talk about in your official capacity as a child protection social worker. Mm. You're being deflected onto a discussion about elements of legal procedure or semantics.
Well, you haven't sent out the minutes.
Yes. Well, you haven't sent out the minutes, or your visit got cancelled. Mm. Sometimes...
You turned up late,
and you know, social workers are always on the back foot with that one because you know, they get stuck in traffic or if there's a crisis, it's very hard to explain to a family, well, I'm really sorry, what I had to go and do was X, and I had to go to court in a hurry when I'd said I'd come out and see you. And I suppose another element of that is when you have to go out and deliver bad news. Mm. So if you've tried to negotiate a package of support, and it doesn't materialise, that's really hard because families are banking on that happening.
Mm. Or a change in the level of support. I think even some of our families in disability services, perhaps adult services as well, where what they'd hoped for in terms of education, special educational needs, the package that they'd been expecting or had become accustomed to has been changed. And you need to go and tell them that,
And it doesn't help to be able to go along and say, well, we've got a complaints procedure.
No.
Because what you want to do, I mean, what social workers always want to do is make things better. Mm. And it's really tough when you have to go and say, well, in this circumstance, it's not going to be quite so easy, or something has changed. Mm. It's hard when a service changes or goes away. Mm. So some of the ones where they're funded externally and we've been used to using them, they go, and trying to explain to people why they're not there, that's tough anyway.
I was interested in what you were saying about being deflected, that some families can become quite skilled at deflecting our attention away from the lived experience of a child by pulling in all the other things that you're doing wrong, or your service is doing wrong, or what school are doing wrong, or the mental health profession are doing wrong, and are able, some families are very articulate, very bright, very able to kind of generate a lot of noise around a child, around services and activities and people not doing their jobs, and can create quite a lot of noise around that. Mm. And it's easy for our attention to be taken away from what's the lived experience of these children in this family.
That's exactly it. Mm. You then have to refocus them back onto, okay, so you might not be happy with me, you might not be happy with the law, you might not be happy with the circumstances, you might not be happy with that. There are things you can do about that. But when it comes back to it, when this happens, this is the effect on your child. Mm. This is what it's like for your child. And if you've done some great direct work with children, you've got a rapport with them, or you work with someone who does know that child really well, it's easier to present that evidence. Mm. It's harder when you have to remember that sometimes the children in that situation who don't feel able to say anything, or for them, they don't quite feel safe enough to say anything. So you have to you have to be the one that represents them. Mm. You have to stand in their shoes and say, actually, hang on a minute, this isn't right. So we can talk about all of that, but actually we need to come back to this. Mm. And this is what it's like every day for this child when you argue like this, or if you threaten like that, or you ignore your child. Mm. It's about getting back to what's really important. Mm. Mm. The other thing that we thought about when we were thinking difficult conversations was the what do you do when you've got a family where patterns of behaviour are normal for them. Mm. So thinking about families where there's been chronic neglect for a long time, and you or other services have been visiting for ages and ages and ages, and you've tried to work on parenting, and you've tried to work with the family to get into routines to manage things better, but it's got to the point where actually someone has to say, the way things are at home, it's actually going to impact on your child's mental health. Mm. It's going to impact on their physical health. I mean, I can't stop thinking about the link between tooth decay in children and heart disease. Mm. And it's the stuff that we learn every day, and things like how children's brains developed when they're starved of the right kind of emotional interaction with their parents. And you're going along with a parent who's doing their best, but you still have to say, we've got to deal with this because this isn't good enough. And particularly if there's been a lot of intervention before and it's not worked, and you have a family who don't get it, or they get things a bit right and then it slips down a bit, and they get it a bit right and it slips down a bit, and it's just like, so why now? What's different now? So I think sometimes that's about being brave and naming it. Sometimes that's about saying, well, we've tried all these times and all these things.
While you were talking, I was thinking about what gets in the way with that. And sometimes when you know a family's trying really hard, you don't want to put more pressure on them. So you kind of ease off on telling them that home conditions are really not good enough, because you can already see they're at their limit. Yeah. And you don't want to push them anymore. So sometimes that difficult conversation is because you over-empathise with where the parent's at. And you know that they haven't got any more help, any more resources to draw on, and yet you also know that it can't continue like that. I was thinking about the social consequences of children growing up in a place where the home conditions are not good enough. You know, because they sit alongside their peers at school, and if they smell or they're unkept, then stories start in the peer groups, and that becomes a part of the children's identity then. They begin to then see themselves as the one who no one wants to sit next to, and the impact that that has on their self-esteem as they go through years. It's years for them before them to be able to shake or repair that level of self-esteem.
And that's happening, it's a not very subtle form of bullying. They won't be concentrating on lessons, so it's going to impact how they, you know, there's not only the social relationships, but how they learn. And we know there are formative stages to that. Interrupt that and you can affect their learning for the whole of the rest of life. The impacts are huge.
So perhaps the motivation for the worker in those situations where you over-identify with a parent or you over-empathise with a parent is refocusing on what is this like for the child now and long term. And maybe that's where you get the energy from to be able to refocus the eco map and the genogram, so all the services around, because it's not just our job to work with families in that way. There's other services that can help with that as well, to mobilize the network around a family in order to improve home conditions.
And also you've got to go along with just an enormous well of empathy, because you might be going along and saying to a parent, actually, we aren't getting this. This isn't right. This is starting to impact on the children. That here's all the evidence. We've done our graded care profile. We've done all of this. Things aren't getting any better. We've been doing this for how many of years? And it's time that this stops. And knowing that that parent is thinking, but I love my children. And just really acknowledging that actually that is an awful sort of thing for them to have to experience, and just being able to be a human being about that situation, because it's tough to have to be able to deliver something like that and stay there and comfort that person and say we're going to put the children first. That's a tough one. Social workers, it feels like you need to have a big sack of that over your shoulder and carry that around with you. And that's when you need to. That's when you need to make sure you've got support as well, because we don't choose to to have to deliver stuff like that to families, and it's tough for us to do that as well, because we're basically lovely people.
Well, you've come into the job to help families.
Absolutely.
And so that's what you're there to try and keep children safe.
Yeah.
And so everyone's, social workers are starting from that basis of trying to do that.
Yeah.
I was thinking one area we haven't thought as much in detail, I was thinking about, which is also a difficult conversation, perhaps more for supervisors than for social workers, but how do you invite social workers to notice times that they are the ones that create difficult conversations, perhaps by their use of self or the way they might invite resistance from families? Or part of inviting social workers to think about the patterns that they create when they engage with families. Are they creating the same sort of difficulties? And there's something about resistance is in the relationship rather than in the person sometimes.
And
the way, working with families in a very do-to rather a do-with approach can be unhelpful. Your choice of language can be unhelpful.
Yeah.
Not following up on your agreements,
going
back on your word. All those things can create resistance and difficult relationships. And how could a supervisor use supervision as a way to invite that reflection from social workers?
What do you bring to the
table?
What
do you create when you work with families?
Yeah.
How does that help prevent and reduce risk to children?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Good point. Good point, well made.
Thank you.
One of the most difficult conversations to have, I think, just thinking about going to court.
Mm.
No one ever wants to go to court. It's not what social workers go to work for. And they have to be so prepared and so ready to take that step into court and say, this is what we think is happening. And I don't think families realise how often the judge will say, no, I'm not convinced, and you need to go back and work
again. Try something else.
And then you come out of court and you have to go back to the family and say, all right, so I didn't get the court order. The local authority didn't get the court order that we were looking for. Mm. We now have to work together again. How are we going to do that? And I suppose what you do at that point is you have to pick up the pieces of the relationship you've tried to build with the family, or that you have with the family. You have to be honest about what's happened. I think you don't stop being honest about the concerns if you still have them. You have to reflect what part of the preparation, was there anything missing? Have I missed something? Was there more evidence presented at court that we need to go back and look at? Sort of the sort of refresh your approach and look again at your assessment. And sometimes you might have to talk to your supervisor about whether you're the best person to continue working with that family, because it's an extraordinary circumstance. It's something that happens so rarely. There's not a lot of sort of, you don't have a textbook and it just says, oh, right, you've done this and you must do this. You have to work it out from situation to situation and family to family and know that relationship will have taken a real hit.
I think some of that happens in the preparation for going to court, though, how you talk about preparing a case for court.
Yeah.
Because you can be more neutral about going to court, as in, court is the place where we all get an even hear. You'll have a chance to be heard and spoken to, and we'll have a chance to present. And it's for a neutral person to make the decision as to what's the next best steps for your child.
Yeah.
And if you prepare a family for the fact that they might go against the social care, then you're not kind of doing a them and us right in the preparation side.
Yeah.
So then you can recalibrate. What did the family take from the court process? What did we take from the court process? And how are we going to learn from that and go forward to keep a child safe? Which is ultimately
what it always
for.
Comes down to. Always
it's
comes
about
back to.
Best outcomes for your
for
children.
That child. Interesting. So for all we were having a conversation about managing difficult conversations, actually we've talked a lot and there is so much to think about and hold in mind. It's one of those things, it shows you everything about social work and all the skills and the knowledge that you have to have. And it's just encapsulated in this one topic. But I'm also aware that we can't keep talking about it forever. So we're going to have to wrap up and think about what we do next time, if there is a next time. So I'm Anna Cullen, Principal Child and Family Social Worker, Cambridgeshire County Council, as previously advertised. Particularly, thank you, Lynn, for doing this. It would have been impossible to just talk about this to a camera, and having being able to talk about it and having different points of view makes the subject come alive.
Thank you for inviting me. Been a pleasure.
And thank you. Thank you for joining us for this episode. Keep a lookout for other episodes of Social Care Cambridgeshire. And if you found this helpful, get in touch with us and let us know if there's more you'd like to see from us or stuff that you'd like to do.
Join us next time for more insights into social care from Cambridgeshire County Council.